Yeah, I did change the title a little bit. I'd want to say thanks for organizing this conference. It's been a really stimulating week, lots of interesting thoughts. So many interesting thoughts has probably pushed out the thoughts I had when I was writing this talk, unfortunately, but hopefully I'll be able to get back to it. So like Joe Emerson was saying that the best time to give the talk's in the morning. If the analogy to the judicial system's anything to go by, then it goes down and down, the chances of acceptance until lunch. So I'm in the second best slot, so hopefully I'll be given parole instead of being put in jail or whatever. Okay, so the theme of this conference is generalizing quantum mechanics, right? So we've heard a bit about different reasons for doing that. I mean, we're not just doing it for kicks. We want to maybe get a theory of quantum gravity, maybe solve some conceptual problems with quantum mechanics, or maybe just understand quantum mechanics itself better as part of some landscape of different theories. So when we're doing that, of course, reformulation is very important. So the mathematical aspect of like getting different formulations of the theory is very important because it's hard to see exactly how you might generalize the Hilbert space formalism just looking at it, as some people have mentioned already. But even more important somehow is the strategic aspect rather than the mathematical one. I mean, if you're trying to get to quantum gravity, as I think Raphael and Lucien emphasized yesterday, what's essential? What things about the theories we have now do we think are going to survive in that new framework? What things do we think maybe aren't so important, things that we can jettison when we're going towards that goal? So yeah, what things are really essential? So I've picked on quantum non-locality because this is an interesting place to focus on when you're thinking about generalizations of quantum mechanics, because it's really one of the places where quantum mechanics does want the most violence to our intuitions. And not only that, but I'd say it's more than a matter of intuition. It's how we kind of did physics, and it has a lot to do with how we reason. So it's more than just a matter of intuition. So concentrating on that issue might give us some really good pointers as to what the really essential matters are. So I'm going to talk about those kinds of issues in this talk, just to fit it in with what people have been talking about in the panel discussions. So what am I talking about? So we're talking about correlation experiments, Bell experiments. Some correlations are allowed by quantum mechanics, violate Bell's local causality condition. So equals R weird, I've put, so I agree. I think these things really are strange. But not all correlations allowed by the no signaling condition are allowed by quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics sits in between the most general things you could expect to get from such measurements based on no signaling and the things that you could get based on the notion of Bell locality, somewhere in between. So that kind of makes you think, well, we've got two principles at either end, this operational one and this sort of ontological one of Bell's. Quantum mechanics is sitting in between. So maybe there's some remnant of that idea of locality which is operative in quantum mechanics, which is restricting the correlations we're allowed. So that kind of points towards some underlying principle here. So the task here is to look for some simple or physically compelling principle or principles behind this limitation of quantum mechanics. It's kind of a more limited game than the one Lucien is playing with, looking for some simple and physically compelling postulates behind all of quantum mechanics. We're just concentrating on one particular weird aspect of quantum mechanics. So as I was saying before, such principles may have many uses. It helps us to understand the theory and reformulate it. Maybe that will help us to do work in quantum mechanics. And it might also help us to empirically test the theory. If we find a principle which restricts to some set slightly bigger than quantum mechanics, then there's room for empirical tests there in that gap between whatever our principle says we should have and what quantum mechanics says. And also, as I said, looking for generalizations of the theory. So what kinds of things? So in this talk, I think about half the material is going to be very familiar to half the audience and half of it's going to be familiar to the other half. So I'm taking the fact that I'm the last speaker as a sort of excuse to be rather vague and sort of basic level. So this is a picture of the famous CHSH Bell experiment. So here, there are two systems and they're supposed to be space-like to each other. And maybe something happens in the past that we've set up that influences these two systems. And then each box, we have these two sort of operational boxes on each side. Each one of them's got one setting on it, which is that sort of circle with the arrow in it in this diagram. And it's got an outcome. So there are two systems in this CHSH experiment. And each one has two possible values for its setting, two possible measurements that they could do. And each one of those has got two possible outcomes. So I've let the settings be valued in 0, 1, but I've valued the outcomes in minus 1, plus 1, in analogy to sort of a spin or something like that, which is normally what you're thinking about. So this is the basic situation, and what I mean by these correlations I was talking about is the set of full joint probability distributions for all of the different kinds of measurements. So that's this thing. Where's the hockey stick gone? I need to threaten the board. So that's this thing here. So given both of the settings, what's the probability of getting some particular set of outcomes? So X, Y are the settings here, A, B. I'm going to use that terminology the whole time. So there's four different probability distributions of this kind indexed by different values of X and Y. And so if you take out the normalization, there's 12 numbers there. And that gives you what I'm going to call the experimental behavior for such a situation. So that's what it says here. A behavior for the Bell scenario specifies the probabilities for all global outcomes given the global setting, by which I mean both. So this is just the most simple Bell scenario. You can imagine one with more systems, or more settings for each system, and more outcomes for each setting. And that's, and you can even go further than that and start to talk about Kolkin-Specker kinds of scenarios as well as these. And a lot of the stuff I'm going to say is really relevant to the whole thing, not just CHSH, but that's the simplest sort of non-trivial, simplest interesting example that fits into the framework I'll be using. So I'll keep on referring back to that. So these classical correlations of Bell's, there's this nice result. So what I'm going to try and do is talk about the classical situation first, and then think about if there's any way to weaken that to bound the quantum correlations. Because we understand the classical one quite well, and there's this group of really nice equivalences in that case that we can try to exploit or try to generalize to the quantum case. And here they are. So what are these three things I've written here? Well, Bell inequalities are some linear constraints on the space of possible experimental behaviors, as I just defined them. Local causality is Bell's condition, his sort of causal, relativistic causal condition, which you probably are aware of. And this thing at the top is the existence of a joint probability distribution over all of the outcomes, which is kind of a non-contextuality kind of assumption. And all these things in the classical case, they're all entirely equivalent. So I'll explain these things in a bit more detail. So I'm calling these things the three C's. The first one's non-contextuality, so it's not really exactly a C, but that'll have to do. So, right, so I'm saying, so this is the joint probability measure one, which I put at the top in the previous slide. If you're doing one of those CHSH experiments, you can imagine that. So what would it be like if there was really a hidden value for each of the experiments you didn't do? There was actually lurking there some property in the system which determined that value. And you're just, when you do an experiment, all you're doing is revealing that value. Then that says, so what I'm trying to get at is there'd be a joint probability distribution over the outcomes for all of the possible measurements you could do, not just the one you actually did. So this is supposed to be the outcome for the A experiment set on setting 0, and this is the outcome for the A experiment on setting 1. So this thing here is a set of, in the CHSH case, 16 different little atoms in a sort of space, a sample space, instead of that experimental sample space of 4 points I was talking about before. Given one of the elements of this space, then you could work out what the result was for any of the experiments, even the ones you didn't actually do. So we don't have access to that information in real life, but what if it was like that? That's the condition of having a joint probability distribution. There's a probability distribution over this space, such that the experimental probabilities for any of the measurements are given back by marginalizing over the experiments you didn't do. So that's what this X slash is supposed to be. It's the Alice experiment, the A experiment, that isn't AX, and you just sum over those ones, and then you get the one that you actually did do. So it's the results are merely revealed. So that's a sort of non-contextuality in this situation. Next, how do you get from that? So actually, Bill said something about this already. So how do you get the correlations from that assumption? Well, assuming the existence of a joint probability measure, this thing here I'll refer to quite a lot, actually. This is like the average of the product of the two spins, the outcomes. So it's the expectation value for the product of the two outcomes. So you can see this is the definition of it. So it's an operational thing. You can define it in terms of what you get out of your experiment. But given you believe that there's a joint probability distribution, if given that assumption, it expands out like this. So you just sum over all of the outcomes, not just two of them. And if you do that, then you can put a bound on this linear expression here. So probably people are quite familiar with this. This is a CHSH expression. If you make this assumption, it bounds to 2, which is Bell's inequality in this case. Yeah.
But last, I didn't understand the meaning of that summation over A, X,
Oh, should I go back? Yeah. So that's supposed to be, so say, so there's four cases here, which I tried to squash into one, and that's probably the, so say that I was looking for the probability distribution, so I was looking for the operational distribution given that x was zero and y was zero, then I'd sum over a sub one, b sub one there to get that. See what I mean? So that's, it's x is, slash x is one minus x.
Summing over all cases that you're not considering.
Yeah, exactly. So in this, yeah, in this special case, like slash x is one minus x, but yeah, for, in general, you'd sum over all the ones you didn't perform. Right, and that kind of, that leads to linear constraints on the set of operational things, probability distributions you get out in the end, so that's the second C. And now, why would you even believe in this weird thing? So Bell's reason was that things don't go faster than the speed of light. And his reason, so as Richard said, the best place to read about this is in Nouvelle Cuisine, Bell's later paper, where he explains, he starts off with the idea that there's no superluminal causal influence, basically. And then he formalizes that condition. And it's something like this one at the top here. So these A's, B's, and C's are something like Petros's events from the morning. They're just things that can happen, events in your in some probability space, which I've also assumed exists, over things that happen. So in Bell's terminology, beables. And this is saying, if there's two events, A and B, which are space-like to each other, then they're probabilistically independent of each other once you condition on everything in the relevant past region, which I've made the joint past here. And that condition, plus the fact that your settings don't depend on anything in whatever region it was you chose, whatever set of things you're conditioning on, those two things together imply that the existence of a joint probability measure, as most of you probably already know. So that's kind of the motivation for this. It's really coming from the lack of superluminal influence for Bell. So that's the last one, that's causality. And all these conditions are equivalent to each other. So let's go back to that. So all the conditions, all these three things are actually equivalent. I first showed that, I think, in the case of three, in the case of CHSH, and it's a general result. So incidentally, I didn't put any citations on the slide. So if I fail to mention someone, please tell me. I thought it was probably more important to finish the talk. But okay, so we're back to this slide again. There's this very nice equivalence in the classical case. So that's why I went through all this basic stuff, was just to emphasize this equivalence and how it exists. But that's not really how things are in real life, because the Bell inequalities are violated, so those other two things can't be true either. So that picture's actually not right for quantum mechanics, because, and that's basically the content of Bell's theorem. Okay, so what is right, and how do we derive these probabilities normally in quantum mechanics? Well, we do something like this expression here. So here's my experimental behavior, and we write down something like this. So we say there's a Hilbert space, and we say there's a state on that Hilbert space. And then we say, there was some von Neumann measurements, so some collection of projectors, such that this expression is the one we need to derive this. But the things for, so this is supposed to be something to do with the measurement on the A system, this is something to do with the measurement on the B system, and if they're space-like, these things are supposed to commute. So that's another assumption you make. And then you can use this expression to derive the experimental probabilities. But as I said before, you can't do everything, and I'm not going to derive this, but I'll just tell you it. So here's that correlation between the two spins, given your settings. And this thing over here is called the bias of the A measurement, so that's just the average of the spin. So if the probability of getting up for Alice is a half, you get that, that's zero, basically. So it's just telling you something about what you measure in one of the systems. And it's not hard to convince yourself, there's 12 numbers here if you count the B biases as well. It's not hard to convince yourself in the CHSH case, this completely specifies the behavior. A PR box is something where the following thing's true. So how to describe this, the correlations in the two systems, the spins or these outcomes, are completely correlated unless the setting for both boxes is one. So if you've got 0, 0, 0, 1, or 1, 0, the things are completely correlated. They always come up, both up or both down. If both the settings are 1, so in one of those cases, they're completely anti-correlated. But here, and the biases I've made 0, or well, you have to have them as zero as well for this PR box. So I should mention that this takes into account already that there's no signaling. I should have said that before. Here, so Y, even though there's a Y on the right-hand side, there's no Y on the left-hand side here, and that's to say that the signal, so the setting on the B side doesn't affect the results on the A side. That's kind of built into how I've written things down. So although there's no signaling, you get this maximally logically allowed value of 4 for this CHSH expression. So each of these things has to be between plus 1 and minus 1, and 4 is the most you can get. So how do you get that? Well, you can kind of see it just follows from this expression. This is 1, this is 1, this is 1, this is minus 1. You get 4. But quantum mechanics doesn't allow that. And Bill actually already showed us how to get the Searlson inequality. So from that, you can see this kind of thing's not allowed. So what is implied? What does quantum mechanics... So this is the thing I was talking about at first. Quantum mechanics is situated between non-signaling and Bell locality somewhere. So whereabouts is it? So the first thing you think, so something people try and derive with these principles I was talking about, there are many attempts to get principles which bound these correlations. So this is a linear bound. So this is the first thing you think of. Well, what is the maximum thing you can get for the CHSH? And as Bill showed on Monday, you get 2 root 2 for this expression. So people can try and derive that, but that tells you barely anything. Actually, in the quantum case, that doesn't specify the space of things you can get at all. So this thing's also true. This is stronger than that one, and it's some kind of more complicated thing about these correlators. And in fact, for the CHSH expression, this tells you everything about the correlators that quantum mechanics tells you. But that's not even the end of the story, because that doesn't tell you anything about what the marginals can be. So they can be constrained by in the overall space of these behaviors, specifying these things might put limits on those ones. So that's not even good enough. So then we make up an even more complicated thing. So here's another one, it's even worse. So instead of having the correlators here, I've replaced them with some expression that depends on the correlators and the marginals. And that thing's true as well in CHSH experiments. This is called Q1 for a reason I'll explain in a minute. So the space of things that you can have in quantum mechanics is actually a lot smaller than just the things that obey this. It has to obey all kinds of other conditions as well. And this isn't even the end of the story. This is called Q1 because there's a bunch of conditions like this that form a hierarchy, and all of them have to be satisfied, and they run up to infinity to get quantum mechanics. So it's actually a very complicated story. There's a lot you have to get back if you want to explain this. So I'll talk about that hierarchy I just mentioned. So what's the best, so forget about getting a nice principle for now that explains all this. How do you even, given one of these behaviors, if someone gives you the experimental behaviors, how do you even know if it's quantum or not? Seems really complicated, right? If it's not even expressed by those equations I just put up. So here's a way to do that. So here's a way to explain that Q1 condition. I'll start with that one. That's the first thing in this hierarchy. So an ordinary quantum model, as I said, for the behavior gives a state and a space like commuting von Neumann measurements that reproduce the probabilities. And that was the expression I put over there, basically. So now I'm constructing now a matrix. And in the CHSH case, it's an 8x8 matrix. It's just the matrix that's built out of these traces of PI, PJ, where this PI thing ranges over all of the projectors, which the measurement projectors in your theory. So for each von Neumann measurement here, because there's two outcomes, there are two projectors that summed up equal 1 for each experiment.
So that could be a projector onto both A1 and, I mean, both X and Y and...
So that one's, it's supposed to be one of the local ones. So that's like a projector. This is a projector onto the A system. So you're imagining, if you like, you can imagine a product Hilbert space or something. Okay. So this one...
So can both of them be in the...
Both of them can be on... Yeah, both of them, yeah. So it could be any... Yeah, right, any one of the eight. So you could have... PI could be on the A system and PJ could be on the A system as well. So it's a matrix of all of those things. So they could be on different systems or the same one. So this is really an 8x8 matrix of those possibilities. And if you have a quantum model, right, so if I build the matrix in this way, then this matrix has to satisfy certain constraints. So if they are indeed projectors on the different systems, so if the first one's for AX, for the outcome A on the system X, and the second one's the projector for the outcome B on the system Y, well, this expression here is exactly the one I gave for the experimental probabilities. You're just doing a, if you just cycle, I mean, use the cyclic property of the trace, you see that you're just doing a projection on each system. They commute, so that's just the, that's the experimental probability there. If they're both on the same system, so I've got outcome A for X and outcome A bar, which is some different outcome for the same experiment. So say you're doing, so you've got the same setting, but they're both on the same measurement. There's another constraint there. So that has to equal the probability of getting A on system X. And these two things have got to be the same. So say, to explain this a bit more, why do I have this delta function here? Well, if Pi and Pj are from the same measurement, but they're not the same, they're not actually the same, then they're orthogonal to each other. So then this would be zero. But if Pi is exactly the same thing as Pj, then, well, because of the properties of projectors, you just get Pi rho. And that gives you this probability here. So this is another constraint on this matrix, and it's got to be a strongly positive matrix, because all such things are. Okay, so this is a way of writing this Q1 condition. You just say, so the Q1 condition is, there exists, so I just derived that from quantum mechanics, but the Q1 condition is, there exists a matrix that has these properties. So it's always true if quantum mechanics is true, because this matrix has those properties. The Q1 condition is a condition that's just on the experimental, it's a condition on the experimental behavior, and it's just saying there exists a matrix which has that form of the thing that you have in quantum mechanics. So it obeys these three constraints. So it's something that's always true in quantum mechanics. It doesn't completely characterize the quantum behaviors, but it's something that's always true. So we have quantum mechanics implies the existence of a matrix with these properties, and that is exactly the same thing as that Q1. And then you can work through what the consequences of that are. And I showed you on the previous slide, you get some inequality in the CHSH case, although this is much more, you can say this in much more general circumstances as well. So what are the other ones? If that's one, then what are the other ones going to be? It's going to get even more complicated, right? So having set that up, I'm going to make a really gigantic matrix where instead of having just projectors on either side, this is a whole sequence of projectors. So this Sn is just like Pi, Pj, Pk. It's just a big long string of those eight projectors I was talking about before. And there's some set of these sequences. So now we're considering, instead of just a projector on each side, the set of all length n sequences of projectors from the ordinary quantum model. So the projectors can be in any order, they can repeat, they can be from the different sides, different systems. But now I'm saying all length n strings of these things you can make, I'm going to make a matrix where each row and column is labeled by those strings. So it's a really big matrix now. So it's going to be 8 to the n, where n's the length of these sequences in the CHSH case. And these also form a matrix, and they also have some relations to the experimental probabilities, and they also have some other constraints on them. For instance, if this sequence ends in something that's orthogonal to this sequence, then it's going to be zero, like in the last case. And in some cases, in some cases, you're going to get things related to the experimental probabilities as well. There's a lot of constraints there. So the existence of this matrix with length n sequences, that's Qn. This is a stronger constraint than Q1. So each one of these things implies the lower ones in the hierarchy. And it's been proven. So this hierarchy is due, I said MPA at the top, that's Navasquez, Peronio, and Asin. They've proved that satisfaction of all of these things up to infinity, it converges. So that does actually imply the existence of an ordinary quantum model. So finally, we've characterized the whole set of these quantum correlations. That's how you do it. Okay, so that tells you what's allowed and what's not allowed in quantum mechanics.
What's the operational meaning of length n sequences of projectors? You mean a projection and another projection?
Another projection. So it doesn't really have, it's not an operational thing exactly. The operational content comes from the thing I left implicit here, which is how does this big matrix relate to the operational probabilities?
So this isn't an experiment you can do then?
No, well, I guess you could do it if you wanted to, just like keep on doing lots of projectors on each system. Oh yeah, but even then, I have a different thing on either side of the thing,
yeah.
So you can't actually, no, you can't do that.
can't you with commutators always reduce them down to lower ones?
Right, so those would be some of the special properties. Yeah, so if things commute, then there's going to be relations between some of the things in this matrix, and indeed anything that's a linear combination of something else, you don't really have to. There's lots of relations there, so this is equivalent to a lot of other things where you could just take linear combinations of stuff. And there's lots of different ways to write this, and I actually haven't written it in the simplest way. It's just this way helps me with the rest of my talk, actually. But if you look in the paper, then it shows you the simpler way to do all this and goes through those relations.
Isn't it just probability for a measurement outcome?
Pardon?
I mean, this is just a probability for a measurement outcome.
Well, this string isn't the same as that one. So I suppose, I guess it would be the probability of doing a whole string of measurements, this whole string and then that whole string after that, yeah. But you don't have to do that to use this. I mean, you're doing that Bell experiment, and this is like some hypothetical thing that you're just using to bound it. Yes, that's true, actually, this is.
Is the sequence itself a projector?
No. Okay. So, so multiplying together things that don't commute won't give you another projector. So if you take one projector on the same the system and then another projector that doesn't commute with it on the same system, you'll get something that's not even you won't get a projector anyway. So no. Okay. So let's go back to my original slide. So I'm just repeating myself now to having told you how to bound these correlations and all the complications of saying what's allowed by quantum mechanics and what's not. So that was really trying to characterize this quantum non-locality, the so-called quantum non-locality, and try and figure out how to see why it's like that. But it's a complicated game because those correlations are complicated, like I showed. They're not strictly bounded by some linear thing. It's some crazy set of stuff. And getting back to that is not easy. So let's go back to that original task. Let's look for simple and physically compelling principles behind this limitation of quantum mechanics. Really, we'd like to get more than just that linear Thielson bound. We'd like to get something quite strong. And I'm just recapping what I said at the beginning. So now I'm saying maybe we can use the generalization of the three C's. So there are a lot of other principles in the literature which try to do this, notably Adan mentioned these in his in the panel discussion, so things like information causality, there's this principle that goes under various names, consistent exclusivity, Speckers principle, local orthogonality, and that there's a few other things on the table as well, which I'm going to gloss over for now. But my approach is going to be to use a generalization of that, so instead of somehow making no signaling tighter, I'm going to make Bell locality looser, in some sense. Just try to find something in that space that might be of value when we're thinking about more foundational things. So, and this should look actually similar to what I was saying about the NPA hierarchy, which will come in, I mean, as was mentioned, that does reduce to a sequence of measurements. Now I'm just going to talk about probabilities of sequences in general to try and motivate what my essential principle is going to be. So what's the probability for a sequence of measurement outcomes in quantum mechanics? Well, you can put it this way. I'm putting the sequence on both sides. They'll just sort of, this is the probability of going through. So say it was a single particle experiment you're doing and M1 is a measurement. M1 is the set of paths, or M1 basically says that you go through this slit here. M2 says you go through that one. And you can sort of correlate each one. I mean, you can get a projection for each one of those things and write this expression down. But you can think about these as subsets of a history space in the way that Petros was describing as part of his talk. And so this is one way of thinking about that expression. You don't have to think about it that way for the remainder of this talk, but it's one way to think about it. So you can say A is the space of all, it's the set of all histories which have this property of going through there, then there, then there, then there. And then you can make a path integral expression of that. So it's just a rewrite of that using Feynman's terminology. And you get that delta function at the end is kind of just like saying that you've got to have, it's kind of like the orthogonality of the final projector. So that's a kind of a history way of writing this down. This has been referred to a lot of times as the quantum measure in other talks. And you can make more general things of A. So A doesn't have to be something to do with particular times. You can just say, what's the probability of going through some zone in space-time or something like that? So it's got a nice space-time feel to it. and that makes people happy when they're thinking about quantum gravity, for instance. So what's essential, and this has been, this idea about what's essential has been mentioned both by Howard and by Raphael and Petras, so it comes up in a lot of different places. What's essential about quantum mechanics? Well, there's this non-locality, there's this non-contextuality. People have mentioned interference, and well, the two-slit experiment was kind of what people thought was weird about quantum mechanics before they learned about Bell, and that really freaked everyone out. But there is something, the whole non-contextuality, non-locality thing is related to interference. Actually, as Petras pointed out, the Koch and Spekko experiment is sort of an interference result, in one way of saying it. So you can look at interference as being quite general, even though, so say in Rob's toy model, which you're probably familiar with, it's a local hidden variable model with an epistemic restriction, and he can say, so there are some situations in which interference is nicely explained just by some common sense model in that case, but there are others like the Koch and Spekko scenario where it's not so easy to make arguments like that. So there is something about interference which is weird and does belong to that class of truly strange things about quantum mechanics. So here's kind of, let's just think about the operational side, probabilities of a sequence of measurements again. So A is the particle went through slit 1 and ended up at point X, B is particle went through slit 2 and ended up at point X, and A or B is just particle ended up at point X. Now we know that, as Petros was emphasizing this morning, these probabilities don't add up like they're probabilities, because I've kind of hidden away something here. I didn't put at the end, we measured for this thing and we found it didn't. So, okay, ordinary probability theory obviously applies to the operational experiments you're doing, but if you kind of leave off that thing about which measurement you do and just consider that measure over all spaces, or over all the events in the abstract, you find that this function doesn't add up properly. The probability of that if you measured it plus the probability of that if you measured it doesn't equal the probability of that had you measured it. However, the following thing is true, which is some kind of expression of there's no irreducible tripartite interference. All you need to know is the interference between two individual events to work out, every pair of most fine-grained events to work out all the interferences. So here, if this wasn't true, then even if you knew the interference between all the most fine-grained paths pairwise, you couldn't rule out the fact there might be interference between all three. So this rule is kind of banning some kind of higher order interference. And there are two other things which are true as well. So the probability of the whole space is one, and all of these things actually are greater than zero still for all events. So those are two other things that are true about this thing, this so-called quantum measure business. So why is that true? Why in quantum mechanics is there no third order interference in that way? Well, here's another one of these sequences of measurements. So this is just a simple case. I'm defining this matrix, it's been referred to as the decoherence functional, but just for these two events. So let's say there's a whole sequence of slits you go through, and then there's a choice of going through slit A or slit B at a time, particular time, and then there's a bunch of other slits. And A is the sequence of events that does all that and goes through slit A, and B is the sequence of events which does all that and goes through slit B. And I've defined this matrix, which has A here and B there, and these are all just the projectors on the other slits, and these ones are the only ones that differ on the two sides. So if you want to work out the experimental probability of getting A, it's the diagonal part of that. So you put the same things here as here. So that would be A here and A here, which I didn't actually put down. If you wanted to know B, it's the same thing, it's just a diagonal. So you put B on both sides, that you rub that A out and put a B. But if you want to know A or B, so you know, we don't care what happens at T star that time, but we want to know the probability of everything else happening. You don't just sum these two together. That would be the Kolmogorov rule, which we've said isn't true anymore. But all you need to add is some pairwise interference between the two things. There's like DAB and DBA. You add those on, and then you've got it. So you just have to add on these intermediate things. So you only have to add on this pairwise term to work out what A or B is. And that actually goes all the way up, so that generalizes to all the sets of events you could be thinking about. You only need this pairwise thing. You don't need anything else. So all you really need to know is this matrix, is what I'm saying, to work out all of the experimental probabilities for sequences of measurements. Oops, that's not right. Okay. I think I've covered that actually already. How am I doing for time? Maybe. Time no longer exists. 20 minutes. Okay, should be able to get to the end. Okay, so that thing, as I was saying, is a decoherence functional. So if we take that as the essential property of quantum mechanics, there's no tripartite interference. Say we run with that and say, now we want to just consider all theories for which that's true, and we don't care about all the other parts of quantum mechanics. How does that limit what we can do? So here's another way to say that. If we define this quantum measure, these experimental probabilities, as the diagonal bits of this decoherence functional, you can axiomatize that like this. And actually, this whole idea goes back to Jim Hartle. So he first gave this kind of this thing he called generalized quantum mechanics in this circumstance, and he thought that would be really useful for considering the problem of time in quantum gravity. And Raphael Sorkin has since refined this idea and really brought out that notion of the tripartite interference not being there. So here, in this axiomatization, it will make things easier for me later on. This is a Hermitian object. This omega is the space of all things, so it's normalized. So it's Hermitian, it's normalized, it has this positivity property, which I mentioned before. So all of those quantum measures are above zero. And it's got this biadditivity. So if A and B are disjoint events, then they just add up normally on one side of the decoherence functional. But that's a good set of axioms. But actually, if you go back and you try to find out what this allows with no signaling, you find it allows PR boxes. It allows everything. So this is kind of a weak sort of specification of what goes on. I won't go into that. But there's a reason why this is. You can't really consider this complete. And it's actually might be interesting to Dan, who uses a similar principle. This isn't closed under composition. We need to consider what would happen if you have systems which are completely isolated from each other but existing in different parts of space. How do we deal with that? Well, in quantum mechanics, we usually just take the tensor product and we can deal with that really easily. But if we only have these axioms, then you might start off with two decoherence functionals for two different systems, try and take the tensor product of them, so you'll just multiply together all the little elements to try and find out what's happening for the big system, and you'll get something which isn't positive anymore by this definition of positive. So they're not composable, these things. They're not closed under composition. That's ugly, and that's, well, it just doesn't really make any sense if you were to consider this as a fundamental law. So if you want a set that's closed under composition, so if you take two systems and take the product of them, you get another system in your set. A good way to do that is just to say this matrix, where these are the most fine-grained events for any two fine-grained events, that's a positive matrix. So we call that strong positivity in this circumstance. So that's more than this thing here. That's saying this thing's a positive semi-definite matrix. So that's a stronger condition. And that's actually the thing that does all the work when I come to try to bound the quantum correlations. This thing's a positive semi-definite matrix in the matrix sense. So let's go back and let me try to rebuild that nice triangle of equivalences that I had in the classical case and see if I can get some insight into what's going on in the quantum case by kind of applying these analogies. So the quantum measure is a bit like a probability distribution. Can I apply that analogy to get a handle on what's going on in the quantum case? Well, this is going way back to the beginning of the talk where I explained what a joint probability distribution was. These are the experimental probabilities, and you get them by marginalizing over the experiments that you don't do. You just sum over the probabilities for the measurements you don't do, keep the ones you do, and then you get back the experimental probability. So it's just like those other measurements were there but hidden somehow from you. So now I'm going to say, okay, well, if these quantum measures are like probability distributions, let's say the same thing. Here's the probability distribution. Now I'm going to say, what happens if I say there's a joint quantum measure? So there's a quantum measure over this joint probability, there's a quantum measure over this joint sample space that gives you back the probability, the experimental probability. So now this thing doesn't have to satisfy the Kolmogorov rule anymore. So we've got a little bit of extra freedom, and you can do more things. And I'll just fill in a bit more detail here. So in terms of the quantum measure, so these things are here because when you do an experiment, you have decoherence, which means, so here I've written, it's So instead of being a marginalization over probability distribution, you can marginalize over the experiments you didn't do in the decoherence functional language. So I'm just summing over the measurements you didn't do on both sides of the decoherence functional. And also, if it's a real experiment, then in a real experiment, probabilities do add up by the normal sum rule. So that's why I've put these deltas in here. I don't want A0 being different on both sides once I've coarse-grained up to the macroscopic level. So AX has got to be the same as A bar X. That's decoherence in most people's language. But the essential thing here is in the classical case, we're marginalizing over a probability distribution. In the quantum case, I'm doing something just the same thing if you've bought the argument about the quantum measure. I'm just marginalizing over the decoherence functional instead. So that's limited contextuality. It's somewhere between just no signaling, complete contextuality, and complete non-contextuality, like a lot of these principles. Right, so how strong is this principle? Can this get us close to that quantum set, which is so hard to even get a grip on? The existence of this joint quantum measure, as I'm going to call it, JQM, implies that Q1 condition, which is quite a strong condition bounding the quantum set. So I'll describe to you why that is. Well, at the top of the page, I've written this is kind of the definition of what a joint quantum measure is. You can get back the operational things by doing this marginalization over this funny matrix. Now let's construct, here at the bottom is Q1. So I'm going to go from there to there. And here, this is the definition of this Q1 principle I gave before. There exists this big matrix gamma with all of the, which is indexed by the different local experiments you can do with these three properties. So let me define, first of all, gamma for two measurements on the same system. You just marginalize over everything except, so this is AX, A bar AX. So then you just sum over everything but AX, A bar AX in the decoherence functional. You get something which only depends on AX, A bar X after that. And I'm going to just set those to be the components of gamma in that direction. So it's a bit, if you remember what the definition of the decoherence functional was in terms of ordinary quantum models, this is really reminiscent of the whole place that you got the Q1 matrix from in the first place by getting it from an ordinary quantum model. It's basically exactly the same thing. So the B case is exactly the same as the A case. When A is different from B, you do the same thing. So all I'm doing is marginalizing over everything apart from these two particular outcomes. And then you do get something that follows this rule. So you're looking for something where gamma AX BY is the experimental probabilities. Well, so we need to look at AX BY, that component of this gamma matrix I just defined. And you just, by this rule up here, that's satisfied. So I suppose I should get on with it. But this rule up here guarantees that, and the same thing for that one there. And it's a strongly positive matrix just because of the properties of strongly positive matrices. If you sum over rows and columns, you'll get another one. So that implies so the take-home message is that this does imply the first thing in this MPA hierarchy. So how much does that give you? How strong is that as a condition? Well, this is kind of a cheap shot. I've taken this diagram from this paper recovering part of the quantum boundary from information causality. And so I think this is still the case. The tightest bound they can put from information causality for this graph is this blue line. So what is this diagram? This is that CHSH quantity I showed before. And this is another one that you can get from the same argument. So in my case, I was this C was E, and I had 0, 0, plus 0, 1, plus 1, 0, minus 1, 1. That's what this thing up here is. This is a different one where you put the minus in front of the 0, 0. So Bell would bound that as well to be smaller than 2. But in other generalized probability theories, you can get various values of these two things, and they're bounded by this graph. So for the generalized case, a PR box is right up there. So you get 4 for the CHSH, but 0 for this other one. Well, that's the PR box I emphasized. And all the generalized set of all non-signaling things you can get gives you this line, so you can get anything down here. Quantum mechanics puts you on this red line, so you can get anything down here on this diagram. And information causality apparently puts you on this blue line. So from what I just said that the joint quantum measure gives you back this Q1 condition. And that, for this CHSH case, tells you everything about the correlators. So it bounds you to, the correlators are bound to what they're allowed to be in quantum mechanics. So, yeah.
Those labels on the axes, that guy looks exactly like the other one then. Your CHSH4 and the CHSH look identical with each other, except you relabeled zeros as ones and ones as zeros.
Right, so they are, but they, yes, yeah, so you get this bound from the same argument simply by relabeling things, but there's still a relationship. So the symmetry is broken by the fact that I am plotting one against the other. So this one has got the minus in a different place from that one. There's still a relationship between them. So there's still the values you can't.
So why don't I get 2√2 for that one as well?
So this is, so well up there. So you mean why have I gone down to 2 there? Why is the maximal value for this 2?
Right.
Well, you have to, I guess you get a negative value for the other one. No, that can't be it. Oh no, yeah, this only goes down to 2, that's why. Right, so yeah, so if you extended this graph down, you'd see that this red line would go down further and you'd get more values. I've just plotted a bit of it, that's true. This, so if you see this one only goes from 4 to 2 on this axis, there's more stuff down here that you can get to. That's why it is, actually. Okay.
So that lower axis isn't some bound or something?
No, that's just there. Yeah, that's just where they actually plotted it. So, okay. Yeah. So, oh, that's like, yeah, that's it's good clarification. Pardon?
It's symmetric, so you don't need the bound.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. So this line, so we recover this red line. So we're doing better than information causality has done so far on this. But you get way more than that because we're not just, so we get. Whatever expression you try and make out of these correlators, we get the quantum situation. But we get way more than that because this Q1 expression puts bounds on the biases as well. So you get more than you could express with these kinds of graphs. So we're doing pretty OK. But our condition is weaker than some other things you can think of. So it's in the CHSH case, it's weaker than Q4. So that's the fourth condition in this hierarchy. That one implies our condition we found. So given an ordinary quantum model, you can define the joint quantum measure. So here's the joint decoherence functional. If there exists an ordinary quantum model, you can write that as this. So you just keep on doing the projectors, and that's the definition of my joint decoherence functional in terms of the ordinary quantum model. And as you can see, if you remember, it's a while ago in this talk, but if you remember my definition of Q4, it was just that there's some big matrix where all the rows are labeled by, rows and columns are labeled by sequences of 4 operators that has the same properties as that matrix would have in ordinary quantum models. So this condition is actually implied by Q4 because this is just a subset of that matrix. It's just a few, rows of that matrix, and the decoherence functional has got all the properties that it's a weaker thing than having an ordinary quantum model. So it's implied by it. So this is weaker than, or equal to Q4, we don't know. And the folklore about this hierarchy is that each condition is strictly better than the last one. So if that was true, our condition wouldn't actually get you back all of quantum mechanics because we stop at level 4. So if 5 really is stronger than 4, then...
Are these implications are just for the CHSH situation?
No, it's for, yeah, so I should say these are general. The Q1 result is general. You can get that up to, you can generalize that all the way up to Koch and Specker kinds of scenarios, not even non-locality ones. This actually shouldn't, this 4 thing is only for CHSH. In general, it's the number of systems multiplied by the number of settings, this thing up here, because that's the length of this sequence of operators. So for more general things, good point. I'm glad you reminded me of that. It is, so our result actually, and that's another thing which is in comparison to information causality, I should have said on the last slide, that's really a situation for bipartite scenarios, two systems. And it's, you have to beef it up somehow to really get the whole set of quantum correlations, because it's known that any bipartite principle can't characterize the whole set of quantum correlations for tripartite situations. That's a sort of known result due to a Sin et al. So any principle that only talks about two systems isn't going to cut it, isn't going to get the whole thing. And so you have to, if you wanted to get information causality to do that work, you'd have to beef it up somehow. But this thing that we've got naturally applies to all kinds of systems, and so this one sort of naturally goes to the general, that speaks to the general case. So that's another advantage of this whole thing, which I should have emphasized earlier. 5 minutes. Okay, I'm almost there now. So a joint probability measure, does it not imply this ordinary quantum model? So before I was saying, well, it probably doesn't because of this folklore that the MPA hierarchy, each condition really is stricter than the last one. That's not that satisfying. So then I went on the computer, and if anyone else who's familiar with this stuff knows, there's this tool that everybody uses called semi-definite programming. So you can go on the computer and you can try and get it to find joint quantum measures for you, in this case, that obey certain constraints. So I went to the computer and I told it to try and find the biggest value of the CHSH expression it could give me when the bias of A was 0.2. I'll tell you why I did that in a minute. I put that into the computer and I told it to maximize the CHSH expression given this constraint. And it gave me something almost exactly 2 root 2. It's 2 root 2 minus 10 to the minus 9 or something. That's not allowed in quantum mechanics, even for the CHSH expression. So we failed, even in the case of CHSH, there are things in our set, which are outside the quantum set. This isn't allowed in quantum mechanics, because when you satisfy Silson's bound, you're not allowed any bias. When this CHSH condition equals 2 root 2, all of the biases have got to be zero in quantum mechanics. And when you're approximately on it, so these values are ruled out as well. Even if this is a little bit off, that value is ruled out. Now, I can't, people tell me this is good enough to say that a JQM does not imply an ordinary quantum model. They say that if this program that I used to get this thing ran and didn't crash, then it's okay. But I noticed that the constraints that of the being a decoherence function aren't exactly satisfied. They're like satisfied up to 10 to the minus 8 or 9 by what you actually get out of the computer. So I thought, so what you get isn't technically a decoherence function. It doesn't decohere on the right things exactly. It's got these little extra sort of numerical errors. So I thought, well, is this strictly telling me what I want to have? But all the people who work on this stuff say to me, yes, that's fine. If it does that, then it all works. So I'll leave that up to you. It's work in progress. By the time we produce the paper, I suppose we'll have worked out these issues, but I didn't want to put my finger on it right now. So that's where it is. So at the moment, it's looking very unlikely that we've got the whole set of quantum correlations from this condition. So there are things which are in our set of, so there are things that you can get with a joint quantum measure that you can't get with quantum mechanics. So that's interesting from that empirical standpoint. It's something that Miguel Navasquez has also talked about with his condition of macroscopic locality, which incidentally that's the same thing as Q1. If that's really the thing that you think is essential, then maybe we should go and do tests and see if we can get into that space between these models. Okay, so that's the correlations part. So I had this beautiful relationship between these three things in the classical case, and so I wanted to get something to do with causality as well right at the end. So here we had this nice motivation in the classical case. In the quantum case, I can write down something that looks exactly the same as this once you multiply it by mu of c squared or something. And that kind of looks like that, right? It's formally analogous to it. And this is implied by our JQM condition, which I've been going on about. Unfortunately, it's not implied by it because there's some issues with conditional probabilities. If the probability of c can be zero, but the probability of b and c could be more than zero, then obviously you've got a problem with conditionals, so I couldn't get from that to that. So there's a bit of a problem there as well. And that's just a formal analogy. Bell had a nice sort of philosophical reason for picking this. I just kind of, me and Raphael and others just wrote this down because we thought it looked kind of similar, but harder to justify, although it's true in quantum field theory. So causality, that third bit of it is a bit of a mystery still, even though that was my motivation. So here's what we had to start with in the quantum case. I mean, in the classical case. Now, instead of blowing it up with quantum mechanics, I've got something that looks a bit like it in quantum mechanics. So it looks nicer than that other slide with the big scary thing that came out and destroyed everything. Now there's some kinds of relationships here. There's a existence of a joint quantum measure that looks a lot like that top thing. We've got some limitations on correlations. It looks a lot like the Bell limitations over there. And we've got this Forman analogy to local causality, although it's only implied by those things. So it's getting there. It's sort of giving you another picture of something like that that could be true at the quantum level. Right, so I'll just sort of wrap up now. So what have we got to do after showing you all these different results on this thing? Well, are there any more results? So we don't know exactly where this condition lies between Q1 and Q4. Maybe we can prove more stuff. That's the obvious thing. The other thing is, and this applies to a lot of these conditions, what are the relationships between all these conditions? So what's the relationship between this joint quantum measure and Speckers principle, between macroscopic locality, between information causality, and all the rest of it? We don't really know the sort of the logical implications of these things. Maybe one implies another one. We don't really know that at all. So that would be really interesting to look at if we're really trying to narrow things down to something we think is a nice principle here. Having a plethora of them is good at this stage, but really we need to start thinking about what the implications are between these things at some point. Can the gap between ordinary quantum models and these ones be tested? Well, if your motivation for doing this is quantum gravity and you think this stuff's going to only show up in crazy situations like inside black holes and stuff, maybe you don't think you can test this in a lab, but it might still be interesting just as a sort of a zero test of quantum mechanics to look all the way around that space of quantum behaviors, not just at the Tillerson bound. Are there other interesting physical and informational consequences of this generalization? Can you do more information processing tasks with this thing? If you could build, like, can you do encryption and all those kinds of interesting things people talk about in quantum mechanics more efficiently with this stuff than you could? So, and that tells you something about what's the difference between this and quantum mechanics that you can get a handle on and talk about more easily. And the same thing for physical things rather than informational things. Finally, and this is the thing, so next week in Bernasky, I'll be talking about this topic, which is really close to central to my whole the way of looking at these problems. I just wrote down that formal condition of causality, and I've just been sort of making formal analogies to things in the classical situation here. But if that's true, why would that be true? So is there really a limited causality condition equivalent to the existence of a joint quantum measure that we can use to justify this in kind of the same way as Bell justified his classical correlations? Is there something underlying this? Is there really a better way of explaining it? So Rob, in his panel discussion talk, said that he thought that the principle of common cause should be sacrosanct, a very strong statement about causality. And people, Terry and Rob and Raphael as well, have talked about generalizing these notions of locality. How can we think about that? Is there an underlying principle which would make all this clear to us if we could only sort of think about it? So maybe the question is not whether we should keep the principle of common cause, but to what extent we can preserve that in our new physics. And then if we come up with a principle like that, that could really help us to get a picture, know what's going on, as it was said earlier in the week about quantum mechanics, and help us to go towards that thing of really getting a picture of the micro world, however strange it might be. So I think on that note, I'll end.
Mm-hmm.
I-3322?
Yeah, especially the maximum. I'm asking this because that case, whether you're wrong, Q1 is not Q.
No, definitely not.
Okay, so what do you
mean? Well, I tried to do my semi-definite programming and it broke the computer. I mean, that's all I really know about that. So I don't know enough about these semi-definite programming things to do this yet. I need to go to Bernasky and get some advice from some people, I think, about how to do that. But in the case I just showed you, it worked, and the program gave a nice result. I tried to do it with this I-3322, which, for people who don't know, that's two systems, three settings on each system, and two outcomes for each setting. So it's just the next simplest one. And that for that one, so for CHSH, it's a kind of weird situation because everything you can do for quantum mechanics, you can do with two qubits there. But people suspect that for I-3322, to get the bound, you have to go to infinite dimensional systems, right? So it's a better test in some ways. And yeah, the computer wouldn't do it for me. It just cracked up, and I tried a few different ways. So that's watch this space, basically. Maybe when we've made the paper about this, we'll know the answer to that.
More questions, comments?
All right, I'll ask a question if you insist.
That's what you're about to do. I feel it.
Could you think of quantum this decoherence functional measure theory approach as a generalization to the theory of inference, or is that a bad way of thinking about it?
I was wondering about that the other day. You know, like this Cox, this whole Cox way of reconstructing probability theory is a sort of Bayesian thing. So for people who don't know about that, it's kind of, you just look at the rules of logic, of Boolean logic, and then you say, so what if I had some degree of belief about, or the plausibility of each event, which was some kind of real number? And then you kind of, you say that it has to satisfy the symmetries of the underlying logic somehow, and then you get back probability theory. So then you think, then that's kind of suggestive, right? So if you say we've got something else instead of probability theory, then you think, oh, maybe we should have something else instead of the other bit of that Cox argument. Maybe we can get that from some kind of Coxian argument. Yeah, it's an intriguing question. I only thought of it like when I was in Washington, so I haven't had time to get to the bottom of it, though, but we haven't thought about that.
If so, it's sort of very closely related to quantum Bayesianism. And
exactly. Yeah, it would really make a sort of link there, which would be really cool. But I think it's worth exploring, but we haven't done that yet. No.
Anybody else? Oh, let's thank Jeremy.